Thank you very much to Benoît and to Claudine Tiercelin for inviting me to present something in this wonderful occasion. My talk will be concentrated and focused on one particular notion of certainty, which is not the one that receives the most attention in contemporary literature. So the two kinds of certainty that receive the most attention, I think, in the literature, if we take, for example, the paper by Baron Reed in the Stanford, are the notion of psychological certainty, which is the highest degree of psychological confidence for P, and the notion of the objective notion of infallibility, which is one kind of epistemic certainty in Baron Reed's terminology. If we make just two remarks about these notions, so the psychological notion of certainty is a subjective notion. It is a certain sensation which is accessible to subjective awareness, and in that sense, it is luminous that if you're subjectively certain, then you cannot fail to know that you are subjectively certain. But it is a notion which is not truth-related. To be subjectively certain concerns only the solidity of the belief as belief, and not as truth-related. While the infallibility notion of certainty has just the opposite characteristics, it is an objective notion, and many authors have noticed that it is not luminous. I can be infallible and not be aware of it. And this status, and second, it is truth-related notion. It is a solidity of the truth connection between the belief and the fact. So the third notion I want to focus on has one characteristic of each of these two. So it's the notion of firmness or stability, or to give a first approach to it, that's the notion which we would express in sentences like, here I stand and I won't change my mind. So this notion of stability is an objective notion in the sense that your belief could be stable across time, even if you're not aware that it is much stable. And on the other hand, it is not truth-related. You can have a belief that is very much stable and completely false. So it's in that sense, it's really different from the two other notions. And another way in which it's different from the two other notions is that it's a temporal or diachronic notion. It concerns whether the belief will retain your belief across time when more evidence comes. So I think this notion sometimes appears in the literature, but not with the centrality that it deserves, if at least I'm right in thinking that this is the kind of certainty we are typically interested in ordinary life. And in this presentation, I want to make a few distinctions about this particular notion of certainty, or maybe this family of notions of certainty. So, one more point I want to make in introduction is to say that I will be interested in in cases where the application of the word certain or uncertain is a common use of the word, which is not the case for the infallibility certainty. I mean, the notion asking whether the belief that there is here a microphone or that we have bodies and so on, whether these beliefs are certain is not an issue that comes up in natural everyday conversation. So this is not the kind of certainty that we're interested in. The kind of situations, the kind of beliefs for which the certainty is an issue are of two kinds, I think. So the first kind would be the everyday informations, like have I locked the drawer or not? Have I left the keys in the drawer or not? Am I certain about these beliefs? So these are everyday informations. And the second kind of beliefs about which it's important to know whether we're certain or not is what I could call the big issues of disagreement. Issues on politics, whether I'll be right-wing or left-wing or a communist, and issues of religion, whether I'm an atheist or this religion or this other religion, and also issues of ethics, whether I think that surrogate motherhood is okay or not okay, or things like that. These are big issues about which one can be, in a relevant sense, certain or uncertain. And the two kinds of examples are not similar in terms of the dynamic of certainty. So for the everyday informations, there is typically a simple procedure of checking in order to arrive at certainty. And it is a short-run procedure, and then we forget typically about the information. 10 years afterwards, I won't remember whether I had my keys in the drawer or so on. While for the what I call the big issues of disagreement, these are long-lived beliefs, beliefs that I will retain once I've formed them. And arriving at certainty for these beliefs is usually a complex and long procedure. So my focus, my interests in this talk will be mainly about the big issues of disagreement, even though I will sometimes use examples from everyday information's certainties. So in the first five sections, I will make a few distinctions in order to situate my notion of stability and notions that are related to it. And then in the sixth section, I will, if I have time, I will deal with one substantive question. One normative question about whether we should be or we shouldn't be certain in this dynamic stability sense. So let me start with a distinction between subjective certainty or psychological certainty and stability. I think this is stability is best understood by contrast at first, by contrast with the psychological notion of certainty. So in many cases, I think that psychological certainty and stability go hand in hand, but there are cases where they are separated. And I will give two examples where the two come apart. So the first example is a kind of everyday information example. It's called Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? So it's on the handout. Does everyone have the handout? There is a handout that was placed outside. Okay. So I read it anyway. So here is the case. Mark is playing Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. He has just reached the second threshold of the game, $30,000, but he has already used all of his jokers, so he has nothing to lose if he tries answering the new questions. If he fails, the game stops, but he loses no money. As it happens, the question is one he isn't quite sure about. He has a certain inclination to think that B is the right answer, but he is less than fully confident. For 1 minute, he tries to get memories one way or the other, but at one point he knows that he just won't reach full confidence about the answer, and so he makes up his mind. He says, "Answer B, that's my final answer." So in this scenario, we can say that Mark is uncertain about answer B in the sense of psychological certainty. He is less than fully confident. On the other hand, we can say also that at the end, he is certain in an important sense because his mind is made up once and for all. He won't change his mind anymore. His opinion, though it is less than fully confident, is firm or stable. He has stopped inquiring about what the answer is. So let me see. Give just another example, one about a big issue of disagreement, like atheism. So it's the case of David the atheist. David has been brought up believing in God, but then in college he encountered atheist arguments, which he found rather persuasive. He decided to study the matter in depth, and for 3 years he has been reading books defending the pros and cons of theism and atheism. At one point, he comes to believe that he's aware of the whole discussion of arguments on both sides, and from this examination, he is 80% confident that there is no God. He is not 100% confident, but he thinks he will never get any more evidence one way or the other, at least until his death. So he makes up his mind once and for all. There is no God. That's my final answer, at least until my death. So I think David has the same characteristic as Mark. David lacks certainty in the sense of psychological confidence, but he has an important certainty in an important sense. He is firm in his belief that in atheism. Another way to draw attention to my third sense of certainty is to oppose it to a correlative notion of doubt. So if we start from the idea that certainty by definition is the absence of doubt, then any notion of doubt will have a correlative notion of certainty and vice versa. So I will give you three meanings of doubt that corresponds to the three meanings of certainty that we have already seen. So is it the case that David and Mark have doubts or are doubting about their beliefs? If doubt means the possibility of error, it's obvious that both Mark and David, that there is doubt about Mark's and David's beliefs. They could be wrong. It's certainly metaphysically possible that Mark and David are wrong. So they don't have, there is doubt in the sense of possibility of error. But could we say also that David and Mark have doubts, or that they are doubting? Well, in one sense, we can also say that Mark and David have doubts about their respective beliefs, because indeed, they are less than fully confident. A doubt in the second subjective sense is the lack of psychological confidence. And in this sense, both David and Mark have doubts about their atheism or their belief that B is the answer. But on the other hand, there is one sense in which it would be wrong to say that Mark and David are doubting the belief they are asserting, because they are resolved and firmed in their final answer. They have closed any inquiry with respect to the issue. And this sense of doubt was in fact studied by Charles Peirce in two papers that Claudine Tiercelin has carefully examined in her paper on critical common sensism. So Tiercelin has shown that Peirce repudiated the Cartesian, the infallibilist notion of doubt, as a mere paper doubt because it doesn't correspond to our common logic of doubting. So I quote Tiercelin: "Peirce condemns the Cartesian scenario for reasons that pertain to logic, but by logic he has in mind a precise analysis of the natural mechanisms that rule the doubt and belief processes." So the natural mechanisms of doubt are the meaning of doubt we have, the third meaning of doubt, the meaning of doubt as open inquiry. So if Cartesian doubt are not real doubt according to Peirce, what is real doubt according to Peirce? Well, real doubts, there are two elements in Peirce's response. The first element seems to be psychological. Peirce says that doubt is experienced as a kind of psychological irritation. So that's an experiential or psychological aspect. But in fact, if Peirce draws attention to the irritation of doubt, it is not in order to focus on its qualitative character, but rather to focus on its functional role, the functional role of irritation. So this is the quote on the handout. "Doubt is an uneasy and dissatisfied state from which we struggle to free ourselves and pass into the state of belief. The irritation of doubt causes a struggle to attain a state of belief. I shall term this struggle inquiry." So that's the very central notion and original notion in Peirce of doubt as an open inquiry. And correlatively, the notion of certainty we would have would be the certainty as closing the inquiry. Now, the proper expression for this notion of certainty as stability is something like, "This is my final answer, I've made up my mind, and I won't change my mind anymore." But if you take this phrase, "I won't change my mind," you can notice that there is an ambiguity here in the meaning of will. Will can be understood, Anscombe has taught us, either as a prediction or as an expression of intention. So which is the case here? Is this when I say I won't change my mind anymore, am I making a prediction about what will happen of my belief, or am I expressing an intention? I think that both answers are possible, and that there are in fact two notions of stability here. One which I will call stability properly speaking, and the other one which I will call resolvedness. The intentional notion I will call resolvedness, the unintentional, which I will study in the next two sections, I will call epistemic stability, properly speaking. So let's study and let's refine the notion of epistemic stability first. The problem with our first example, the case of who wants to be a millionaire, is that it's an idealized case. The reason why I won't change, or Mark won't change his mind, is just because there won't be any more evidence for him. He's not expecting more evidence to come. So it's not that his belief is stable against future evidence, it's just that it's stable because there won't be evidence pushing it one way or the other. So it's a trivial stability. What we want, it would be more interesting to have a non-trivial notion of stability, a stability which is a resilience to future evidence. But on the other hand, if we go too far in the sense of the resilience, which would be the sense one, which I give on the handout, the fact that I would retain my belief come what may, whatever evidence, possible evidence could come. This is obviously a notion of stubbornness, absolute stubbornness, and it cannot be epistemically interesting. So the issue is here whether there can be an intermediate notion, a notion which has some kind of resilience, but is not, on the other hand, pure stubbornness. And I think there is. But in order to do that, we have to modify the definition of sense one. And the first modification we can make is to say that it's not... in order to be stable, it's not sufficient to retain the belief come what may, but it's important to be such that I would reasonably retain the belief come what may. So to adding this condition of reasonability can make the notion more interesting. The problem is that if we retain this notion of sense two, it seems that we could never be stable because of skeptical possibilities. So it's metaphysically possible that there should appear in the bottom of my visual field a text saying this is all an illusion of the matrix. That is metaphysically possible. And if I did receive this evidence, and even with this evidence, I remain fully confident that I'm not in the matrix, I would be unreasonable. I would be stubborn, and therefore I couldn't reasonably retain my beliefs, at least my everyday beliefs, if I have to retain them against any kind of possible, metaphysically possible evidence. That's a too strong constraint for stability. So a more interesting claim will be to say that I don't have to reasonably retain my belief upon any kind of metaphysically possible evidence, but only against the evidence that are actually present in the actual world, or at least that are present in nearby worlds and not in any possible worlds, in all possible worlds. So that's definition three. I would reasonably retain the belief upon further evidence available in the actual world, or at least in nearby worlds. And another definition which is in the same ballpark is definition four. I would reasonably retain the belief given the evidence, well, the agent would reasonably retain the belief given the evidence he would obtain by pursuing a reasonable inquiry. That's a counterfactual, being interested in counterfactual evidence starting from the actual world. So this definition four, this definition four, the fact that the agent would reasonably retain the belief doesn't mean that the inquiry wouldn't bring up some defeaters. It means only that the agent has defeaters for the defeaters that would come up, or that he would have defeaters if he did lead the reasonable inquiry that leads to his having the defeater. So we could frame this definition for as 4 prime, the agent has a defeater for any defeater that would come up if he were to pursue a reasonable inquiry. So I will give an example of what I mean here. It's the case of even the evolutionists and Lysenko's theory. So even is an American biologist in the 1960s. He's an expert in the theory of evolution, and he knows all the scientifically important evidence about this issue. But politically speaking, he has inclinations for communism. One day, he learns that in the Soviet Union, the official theory of species is not the theory of evolution, but the theory of Lysenko. For now, he doesn't know anything about the details of Lysenko's theory and the evidence Lysenko uses in order to defend it. Because he likes the Soviet Union in general, even suspects that if he were to learn the evidence that Lysenko uses, he might get defeaters for his belief in the theory of evolution. But as a matter of fact, for every bit of evidence that Lysenko uses in favor of his theory, Ivan already has a perfect evolutionist explanation of that evidence. So he presently has the defeaters for all potential defeaters he would acquire in pursuing a reasonable inquiry about Lysenkism. In that sense, Ivan's belief in the theory of evolution is objectively epistemically stable. So it's even strongly stable because he presently has the defeaters. Another case I had imagined is a bit more subtle. It's a case where the agent doesn't presently have the defeaters, but in which he would get the defeaters if he were to pursue the rational inquiry that would lead to his having the defeater. So that's a weaker kind of stability, but it seems to be sufficient for the belief to be interestingly stable anyway. I won't read the example I give for this case of stability, weak stability. I have to move more quickly to the third section, where I notice one important fact about this notion of stability, which is that it is not luminous. It's not accessible to subjective awareness. One can be stable in some belief and ignore that one is stable, and conversely, one can believe that one is stable and not be stable. So let's take both cases. A case where I have a stable belief without believing that I'm stable is precisely the case of Ivan, the evolutionist theorist. So Ivan's belief is stable because he has the defeaters, but he doesn't know that he has the defeaters because he doesn't have knowledge yet about what the defeaters are in Lysenko's theory. So and because of his communist inclinations, he has some reason to believe that the defeaters in Lysenko's theory would be good. So he stops believing in the theory of evolution because of this. So he doesn't believe that his belief is stable, and nonetheless the belief is stable. The opposite case, a case where a belief is believed to be stable, but in fact is not objectively stable. We could take the example of a young religious believer who first thinks that he would have an easy response to any atheist challenge, but later on he discovers that the arguments are more challenging than he thought, and he loses his belief. So at the beginning of the process, he thought that his belief was stable and that he would have defeaters for beliefs that would come, but in fact, his belief was not stable. So stability and belief stability can come apart. Now, let's turn to the intentional notion I talked about earlier. 5 minutes, right? Or?
Yeah, 5, 10 minutes.
5, 10?
Eight.
Okay. 8. Great. So remember what I said earlier about the formulation, "I won't change my mind." This can be a prediction about one's objective stability, but it can also be the expression of my intention. I am resolved not to change my mind. P is what I intend to consider as true from now on. If I change my mind later on, my earlier expression of intention won't be false. It's just that I will have changed my intentions as to what I hold true. We can use here the notion of acceptance, as it was described in particular and discussed by Jonathan Cohen and Pascal Angèle. So unlike belief, which is an unintentional state, acceptance is intentional. And we could give the following definition: to accept that P is to adopt a policy of treating P as true in theoretical and practical reasoning. So if we come back to the case of Mark in Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, in fact, we may doubt that Mark believes that the true answer is B. Perhaps he doesn't believe it, but he just acts as if he believed it. Perhaps he's only accepting P. So it's clear that my notion of resolvedness or intentional stability is close to the notion of acceptance, and yet it's not exactly the same notion, because acceptance may be temporary and fragile. I may accept that P for the sake of seeing where it leads, and with the intention of changing my mind if it should lead to theoretical or practical absurdities. But this is not so when I'm resolved. When I'm resolved to hold that P, I accept that P, but I also make the intention to accept it from now on and not to change any more in my acceptance. So this is a stronger notion than acceptance. And because resolvedness is intentional, is an intentional notion, while stability is a non-intentional notion, they, of course, are distinct and can come apart. And again, we could give examples of being resolved without being stable, and examples of being stable without being resolved. And in fact, the examples will be just the same that I've given for the previous case. The young religious believer at the beginning of his career is resolved to continue believing in theism, but he's not stable. His belief is not stable. And even the evolutionist is stable in his belief, but he's not resolved to believe in evolution, come what may, from Lysenko's theory. Or at least he may not be resolved. So we have seen, for now, we have introduced three interesting epistemic characteristics: being objectively stable for P, believing that one is objectively stable, and being resolved, intentionally resolved, to hold that P. And we have seen that the three characteristics can come apart. What I want to do in the fifth section is to see one case in which they are not independent from each other, but on the contrary, are interestingly related to each other. So resolvedness, remember, is an intentional attitude, and for that reason, it is subject to practical reason. One kind of practical reason that one might have for being resolved, for example, in believing in God, is Pascal's wager. I know that believing in God has a good expectancy, while not believing has a bad expectancy, and for that reason, I resolve to believe in God until my death. But that's a very practical kind of reason to be resolved. That's not the kind I'm interested in here. The kind I'm interested in here is more epistemic, and I will describe it through the example of the inquiry of Pico della Mirandola. So, which is the example of mine who has read everything. So Pico starts his philosophical career as a very curious young person and starts reading tons of books on philosophical issues, in particular about the theory of mind, which bothers him a lot. At the age of 25, he has read half of the literature on the matter in philosophy of mind. And because there remains one half to read, he decides not to resolve himself, though he is already strongly inclined toward the functionalist theory of mind. Between 25 and 30, he reads one more quarter of the literature, so that by the age of 30, he has read three quarters of the literature. There still remains one quarter he hasn't read. And absolutely speaking, there might be arguments in the remaining quarter that might change his mind. But between 25 and 30, Pico has made the following remark. All the arguments he has noticed in these 5 years were either arguments he knew already and had defeaters for, or arguments in the same ballpark as those he knew and for which it was very easy for him to come up with a defeater. Now, Though it is possible that the remaining quarter contains arguments of a different sort, this seems quite unlikely to Pico, given the way he has investigated the literature. In other words, Pico is in a position to reasonably believe that his belief in functionalism is stable with respect to the remaining quarter of literature. And reflecting on this belief stability, Pico decides to make up his mind, to be resolved that functionalism is true, which means that he ceases to treat it as an issue of open inquiry for him, and he doesn't read the last quarter. So, in this scenario, Pico adopts intentionally a certain attitude of resolvedness, but he doesn't adopt it for narrowly pragmatic reasons. He chooses to make up his mind once and for all because he thinks that his belief is now objectively stable. Of course, he might be wrong in this belief, since objective stability is not a matter of subjective awareness, but he may still have very reasonable reasons to believe that he's stable. And if Pico accepts functionalism in a resolved way because he reasonably believes he's stable, then his resolvedness seems to me to be optimally rational. This kind of resolvedness I will call epistemic maturity. So I give two different definitions of maturity. X's acceptance that P is epistemically mature means that X is resolved to hold that P because X reasonably believes that his belief that P is now objectively epistemically stable. Perhaps the second one will be easier to grasp. X's acceptance that P is epistemically mature means that X is resolved not to change his mind about P because he has good reasons to believe that nothing will later on give him reasons to do so, to change his mind. So, now, all I have done so far is to give definitions of stability, resolvedness, and maturity. For all I have said, everything remains open concerning which actual beliefs are stable, resolved, or mature. I won't have time here to give an argument for one of these views. I can only state my present view as a proposal for further discussion. I tend to think that in the course of real life, inquiries about big issues of disagreements in politics, religion, ethics, there are some occasions at least, and perhaps many occasions, where we reach the point of having examined a sufficient amount of the evidence in order to be reasonably confident that our belief is now stable. And I believe that these are situations in which typically the most rational of us form a resolved acceptance, precisely because they think that their belief is stable. So I think that epistemic maturity about big issues of disagreement is a standard which is reached by some of us at least sometimes, and perhaps even by many of us in most of the cases in which we are resolved. The final section, which I think I don't have time to address.
4 minutes.
Well, okay, then I'll try to give a very short idea of what I want to do here, the attempt to respond to one objection against this optimistic view of maturity, of epistemic maturity. This objection, we could call the objection from open-mindedness or the possible future evidence argument. So here is the argument. For any proposition P, it's always possible that you will encounter an argument you had never thought about. Second premise, if one is true, then you should always remain open-minded with respect to P, meaning that you should never accept P in a resolved way, and once and for all. Conclusion, for any proposition P, it's never reasonable to be resolved in accepting that P. So the notion there, which lies behind this argument is the idea that in order to be open-minded, you should never consider yourself as having a definitive opinion on anything. And I think this argument or this suggestion is wrong for two reasons. One reason is that I think it confuses two notions of open-mindedness. I think there is one kind of open-mindedness which is completely compatible with being resolved. For example, Pico della Mirandola can be reasonably resolved and yet remain open-minded he won't be open-minded in the sense of continuing the inquiry, but he might be open-minded in the sense that if some new evidence should come up, he would revise his, and some relevant evidence should come up, he's ready to revise his antecedent belief. So he's not looking for more evidence, but he's ready to change his belief upon future evidence if it comes. In that sense, he remains open-minded and is not stubborn or dogmatic in the sense of being for now unable to ever change his mind. But he's resolved nonetheless, because he has stopped making an inquiry. Okay, I think I'll stop here. Thank you.